preserving and promoting Maine's treasured night skies. Did you know Maine boasts the largest expanse of naturally dark sky east of the Mississippi? If you look at a nighttime satellite image, you can see it, a little island of black in a region lit up by city lights and roads. Acadia National Park, in fact, is the only national park in the eastern U.S. in which you can clearly and regularly see the Milky Way. These night skies aren't just treasured by those of us who live here, but also by tourists, some of whom seek out Maine in order to do some serious stargazing. I'm Jennifer Rooks. There is a growing movement to preserve and protect dark skies, and even improve them here in Maine by reducing light pollution further, which research shows can benefit wildlife and people. We'll learn more about the dark skies movement next on Maine Calling. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In many parts of Maine, a look up into the night sky can reveal stars, constellations, and even the Milky Way. But light pollution threatens these spectacular views. Maine is one of the precious places where the dark sky areas exist, and there are efforts to make sure they don't get lost. Today, we're going to learn about the reasons to preserve dark skies. Joining me in the studio, Ed Gleason, who's an astronomer and planetarium manager at the University of Southern Maine. Also here, Nancy Hathaway, chair of the Surrey Conservation Commission and a mindfulness instructor who has been involved with dark skies efforts in Maine. And Doug Hitchcocks is staff naturalist at Maine Audubon. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever sought out a place to see the stars at night? Are you involved in efforts to reduce light pollution? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to you all. Nancy, I know that reducing light pollution and preserving the night sky has been a passion of yours for a long time. How did your journey begin, and why is this so important to you?
I was trying to think of how it began, and I think it began when I returned home to Maine in around 2002, moving from Cambridge, and I bought a house in Surrey, and I opened my car door at 10 o'clock at night, and I went, oh my gosh, looking up at the night sky. And I think that's really how it began. And the so what happened after that? So after that, I thought, well, this really is important. And I started investigating about night sky and found that down East Maine and the North Maine woods have the darkest area of dark sky east of the Mississippi River. And so I found a few people who are interested in the night sky. And we sat in my kitchen and we said, what shall we do about this? And we wrote up an ordinance for the town of Surrey. So the Surrey voters passed a lighting ordinance to, it doesn't really have too much to it, but the idea was to educate and to bring to light the dark sky.
Pardon the pun. but to make sure, I was about to say shine a spotlight on it. It's funny how many light analogies we have in our conversation, but to make people aware of this issue in a way they hadn't before. And that was a while ago, right?
That was a while ago. So then I had this bright idea, right? And I contacted Roxanne Quimby, who owned the 100,000 acres east of Baxter State Park, and I said, oh my gosh, what about making a dark sky preserve out of this area? And she thought it was a great idea, but at the time it wasn't really right. So the time did become right when I partnered with Lucas St. Clair of Elliottsville Plantation.
Her son.
Her son. And we had the first annual Stars Over Katahdin almost 5 years ago. We'll have the fifth one this year. And we used what is now, and what wasn't then, but what is now the new National Monument. And there's an overlook that overlooks Katahdin. And seven astronomers came with their telescopes. And we had a little campfire first and talked around the campfire, put the fire out, and walked up to the overlook. And it was just amazing. The sky was so dark. The Milky Way was so bright. And since that time, we've registered the light I'm not exactly sure of this. I'm not a scientist, but the meter was 21.6 of dark sky, and which is supposed to be like a very wonderful sky where you can see stars that you can't see east of the Mississippi in most places. So this fall, we'll have our fifth annual Stars Over Katahdin, and the Friends of Katahdin Woods and Waters will start sponsoring and taking care of this. And also, I should mention that the schools up in that area have taken this on as a strong interest. So Northern Stars Planetarium comes, and in the gym, John Meter has inflatable planetariums that they blow up, and the kids come in and look at the stars and then come outside later and look at the night sky. And town officials are interested. We're thinking that economically it's going to bring a whole, what they're calling now, astro-tourists.
Astro-tourists. I love new words of the day. That's terrific. Well, Ed, put this in perspective. How special is Maine to astronomers? What does this 21.6 mean? What can we see that can't be seen other places?
Well, it's interesting. Our weather, our frequency of inclement weather actually precludes us from constructing any research-grade observatories here. And so recreationally, however, we have the opportunity to see much more than you could see in other states because of our dark skies. And the light meter value, to be honest, I'm not sure exactly what that means. I do know that more than 95% of people in the United States don't have a completely dark sky where they live. And so people here in Maine, many of them will have a nice dark sky. And so recreationally, people who are interested in astronomy, night sky observing, will actually find Maine a destination. The astro-tourism, I'm familiar with, people have come to Maine specifically to observe the night sky. They won't do that in Greater Portland, but they often will do that in the northern part of the state where there's lots of dark sky because you're far away from many light-polluting sources.
You must be thrilled that so many people are interested in learning more about the night sky after dedicating your life to this.
Well, having a dark night sky does tend to make people more interested in the night sky because it is part of their environment. If you notice, if you read, for instance, Melville stories, you'll notice Aldebaran and constellations will be insinuated throughout the stories because it was certainly part of their life because it was visible. In modern day, a lot of people won't have constellations or stars even visible to them. Therefore, they won't actually factor into their lives like the moon or Venus or Jupiter will.
Mm. Doug, I understand that, and I think that most people are generally aware that light pollution, especially bright lights from cities and airports, can affect birds. And I want to ask you, what's the latest research? What do we know about the impact on birds?
Yeah, the biggest threat to birds is especially during migration. We know, spring and fall, literally billions of birds over the country are going to be flying, especially our, smaller songbirds, the warblers, tanagers, vireos, these neotropic migrants that are mostly migrating at night. And so what we're seeing is that a lot of these birds are either altering their paths or are really misdirected by light pollution, especially over cities. Perhaps the most famous example of it is the 9/11 monument in New York, where hundreds of thousands of birds are caught in the tribute lights that are two bright beams of lights that are sent up in the sky on September 11th, which unfortunately, coincides with really one of the peak timings during fall migration. So we don't really know exactly why birds are so drawn to lights like this, but we do know it causes them to become disoriented, essentially getting caught in those beams of light. So what you see over time is they become fatigued, whether they're going to hit the ground or, one of the unfortunate parts is that it's drawing them to a city where you're going to have higher rates of collisions with structures. The latest research says that it's just under a billion, somewhere around 100 million birds per year that are that die from collisions with structures just in the U.S.
So the birds become it just makes them not able to navigate in the ways that they are programmed to, if you will,
yeah,
by genetics.
We know that birds use things like the stars as navigational aids. There's some really cool research that basically shows that they can look up and know which way they're going. So you can imagine that, something like a bright light and it doesn't have to be something as bright as the 9/11 monument. It can just be cities over Portland, or excuse me, the lights over Portland. Mm-hmm. Even kind of famously lighthouses, which is just a steady spinning beam. You can watch them especially in the fall. I find myself along the coast, and sure enough, birds will just be doing circles with the beams.
Oh, interesting. What about other plants and animals? And what about us? What do we know about the impact of light pollution on humans?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I know more about animals than humans. You know, we've made so many puns here already, but like a moth to a light, it's absolutely devastating for them. Another one that we were not entirely sure why a moth is drawn to a light, we know that it probably has to do with them using the moon as kind of a permanent spot to reorient themselves. So they probably see the something like a bright light and again, are just becoming confused. And what's interesting is that it draws these insects in, especially, and it's not, I shouldn't say just insects, but we know it's having a lot of impacts on mammals, especially rodents. Insects definitely get drawn in. That's going to bring in other predators, essentially making across the food web, making things either more vulnerable or just kind of really changing how these things have come to evolve around light. And it's really kind of alarming when you think that this is probably one of the most dramatic changes that species are seeing, where, you know, climate change is certainly very daunting, but, you know, levels of CO2 have been changing forever, where it's really just in the last 200 years that we've been emitting such extreme levels of light. And we'll have to see how wildlife kind of evolves around that.
Well, it seems to me there are two main goals of those promoting dark skies in Maine. The first is preserving and promoting what we have, the natural dark skies we have. But then the second is reducing light pollution in other places to improve the situation there. You mentioned, Ed, that Portland is not the best place to look at the
nighttime. No, really,
yeah.
But by virtue of its light and its proximity to the ocean, because a lot of light pollution will be created by light going upward and then reflected off the dust and the haze.
Right.
And light going downward doesn't really affect light pollution that much. So if we could somehow persuade businesses to have more downward directed light for safety, as opposed to having radiant light that is wasted upwards.
That's what I was going to ask. What can businesses do? We don't have to eliminate lights, do we?
No, we don't. I mean, imagine a regular street lamp, which is spherical. A lot of the light going upward is of no use to anybody. If they could somewhat shield it, because you do need light directed downward to illuminate walkways for safety purposes, but having light upward serves no purpose. And it causes a lot of the ambient light that obscures the night sky. So if we could somehow persuade businesses to shield the light and reduce the light, which is more cost effective to them, it actually will serve safety and reduce the light pollution that obscures the night sky.
There is a relationship with people in terms of safety, thinking that the more area you light up, the safer it is. But if you look on maybe YouTube or some videos and look at lights that light up the whole area as compared to lights that are shielded, you can actually see better in some instances with lights that are shielded.
Oh, precisely. Because it's directing it downward, and that's you're precisely correct.
And then there's also something about, maybe you know more about this, Ed, but Kelvins. So Kelvins, I believe, are measurements of light. And so there's new LED lights that are going in. And many people, from what I'm hearing, are thinking that LED lights are wonderful. However, there are different Kelvins of LED lights. So there's 5,000, 4,000, and then under 3,000. And the 5,000 Kelvins, which are being put in, offer this sort of eerie light. And the light goes, because it's blue, it goes down and hits the ground, and then actually it does go back up to the sky.
It can reflect different wavelengths of light, reflect at different angles. And of course, if you have something that's bluer or something of that wavelength, it can reflect upward more, depending upon the material on the ground itself.
Right. Whether it's a parking lot or a grassy area or concrete or, you know.
As you notice, of course, walking in a snowscape, you can even walk through a forest without any moonlight because it's reflecting whatever light there is. And so it depends upon how dark the ground is, how much reflects upward.
So if I'm listening to this program and I'm a town manager or, you know, on the selectmen of a town in Maine, how do I know? And I'm already kind of thinking about the lights in town because there's probably more energy efficient options and I can save some money by changing lights. How do I know where to turn?
So I have a story first about a town. I believe it was either outside of Big Bend National Park or actually in Big Bend National Park, which is known for its night skies. It apparently has very dark skies. So because there were so many astro tourists coming to the area, they thought, well, maybe we should put in some new lighting. So they put in new lighting, but what they put in, I believe, was 5,000 Kelvin lighting, which offered sort of this eerie feeling, and also the light started polluting the sky. So they actually, after realizing this, took out all of their lighting and replaced it with a lower Kelvin lighting. So I think that's something for small towns and the state of Maine to think about before, to really think about what kind of lighting we want. And I believe I also heard that 4,000 Kelvins, there was a production, overproduction of 4,000 Kelvin lights. So they're being put in a lot more. They do offer this bright blue light that bounces up to the sky. And the state of Maine, I believe, is doing it. And I did talk to the man in charge of lighting for the state of Maine. And He was wonderful. He had said, "Oh, I just came out of my house this morning from up in Eustis, and the sky was so amazing." So he's interested, but I don't know how much he can affect this. But if towns are putting in lighting, there's a wonderful website, IDA.org. So it's the International Dark Sky Association. And it's a fabulous website. It gives tons of information, and it shows, and they're very happy to talk. It shows different kinds of lighting that towns can put in, or just the regular person outside their home can put in.
Doc?
I was going to add to that. I think it's darksky.org is IDA's website. Their recommendation is 3,000 Kelvin or below. That problem with that blue light pollution. The other thing with a lot of towns or cities that are switching over to LEDs because they're so much more efficient, by default they tend to be a lot brighter. And a nice thing about LEDs is that you can also minimize that brightness. So that's usually one of the recommendations in areas that if it has to be lit, obviously the best solution is to find areas that you can just turn the lighting off. So when is it needed? Where is it needed? But if it is needed, how can you minimize those overall, that brightness?
Well, we do have to take a quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Starry, starry night. Paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Goodwill Northern New England, with a 10-year goal of helping 10,000 households build stable lives through work. GoodwillNNE.org.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest stories of the day to vital context on issues and trends, BBC NewsHour is there to keep you up to date on the world. Through the largest network of correspondents, we deliver unbiased reporting that complements your local and national news. Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour.
You can hear BBC NewsHour weekday mornings at 9 o'clock and weekend afternoons at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter John Leland talks about his year-long assignment following six New Yorkers age 85 and older. At the time, Leland was 55, recently divorced, starting a new relationship, and serving as the main caregiver for his 86-year-old mother. His new book is about what he learned about old age, dealing with decline, and facing death. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Preserving Dark Skies in Maine. With me in the studio, Nancy Hathaway, who is chair of the Surrey Conservation Commission and a mindfulness instructor. Doug Hitchcox is staff naturalist at Maine Audubon, and Ed Gleason is astronomer and planetarium manager at USM. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And joining us on the line now is Mike Taylor. He's a photographer who specializes in photos of the night sky. And Mike, I understand that what they call you is an astrophotographer. Is that right?
Yes. How you doing, Jennifer? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So what does it mean to be an astrophotographer, and how does it connect with the dark skies movement?
Well, the I am a professional landscape photographer, so I make my living, by creating images of the night sky and teaching workshops of the night sky and all that kind of stuff. Astrophotography in and of itself is just taking photographs of the night sky. What I like to do is landscape astrophotography, where I kind of take everything that I learned as a landscape photographer and blend that in so that we have something that gives us scale when we're taking pictures of the Milky Way, stuff like that. You know, if you have something in the foreground for scale, that really helps to kind of, land the viewer in a way that kind of shows your small area in the cosmos.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, we've posted a neat article with some of your photographs on the Maine Calling Facebook page. So if people want to get an idea of what Mike is talking about, what is the best place? Where do you love to go and capture? I noticed you have photographs of the Aurora Borealis and the Milky Way. Do you have a favorite place in Maine?
Well, not specifically. Really, I mean, Acadia is one of the best places, you know, in Maine, just because the landscape is so fantastic. But you know, the big thing about Maine's dark skies is that, as your guests were already discussing, is that Maine is really the last bastion of dark skies here on the entire East Coast. All you have to do is look at a light pollution map, and you can see that, Maine, especially northern Maine, is relatively dark compared to everything else, as you were discussing, pretty much east of the Mississippi. It's really important to me, and I work with, I'm a contributing member to the International Dark Sky Association, which is the only nonprofit organization in the United States trying to bring public awareness of light pollution, and I recommend that, you know, anybody who's interested in this should check them out, because it's a really important group.
Okay, before we let you go, I have to ask you, Mike, if you have any tips. If you live in a place with a beautiful night sky and want to try to capture it, what kind of tip do you give sort of amateur beginning photographers who just want to capture it somehow?
Right, absolutely. The first thing, the major thing, is that you want to have a tripod, because most times we're taking exposures of, 15, 20, 25 seconds, sometimes longer than that. So you obviously can't hand hold a camera for that long without things being blurry. But the main thing that I suggest to everyone is get as far away as you can from light pollution. Light pollution is, will hinder your you know, being able to view the stars, being able to view the Milky Way, you know, the aurora, if there's an aurora display kicking up, it's the most important thing is just to try to get as far away from light pollution as possible.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Mike Taylor, an astrophotographer with Taylor Photography. And again, you can see some of his photographs by going to the Maine Calling Facebook page and looking at today's post. We're going to move on and we're going to go to Lori, who's calling from Wiscasset. Hi, Lori. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I was calling about the problem of lights on businesses. They have these really bright lights that actually blind you when you're driving by them. It seems that it's gotten a lot worse in the past few years, and I'm sure it's contributing to all of this light pollution.
Sure, Lori, do you mean the lights that light up a sign or something like that?
Yeah, well, actually, it's more, it used to be like that, but now they actually have lights, signs that are lighted. They're actually like illuminated LED lights that say things on them, and they're so incredibly bright, some of them, that they when you drive by them, they blind you the way a police car light does when you're going by and they've pulled somebody over. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if you've ever noticed.
Yeah,
those,
yeah.
But I've seen this one in, I think it's National Federal Distributors, actually, out on Lisbon Street in Lewiston, that is just so bright. Every time I go by it, it drives me crazy.
Well, Lori, thanks for your call, Doug.
So I'll just add to that and say, so mentioned moths briefly before, but this is actually becoming a big problem for them, where we know that they're being drawn to these essentially static lights. Not a very charismatic species, but moths do a number, a good amount of pollinating in the state. So there's a lot of our plants that really rely on moths. And if they are constantly being pulled from, a large area that they're covering, it's something like, I think, 75 feet that a lamp will actually pull insects from, up to 75 feet away. So you can imagine you've got this essentially this large area around any of these bright lights that are probably not getting at least the diversity of pollination that they need to preserve that overall biodiversity.
So Nancy, I understand Maine has outdoor lighting regulations. It was one of the first states to have outdoor lighting regulations. Does it not cover these kind of signs, or are they not strict enough? I mean, what's going on?
I've heard this, that the Department of Transportation has some lighting regulations, but honestly, I don't know. I don't know about the details. And I also know that the ordinances that where different towns are trying to pass ordinances, and it's difficult because it's hard to pass ordinances in towns. Yeah.
Well, Lori was talking about one business in particular that, you know, every time she drives by, she wishes the lights weren't so bright. Would you advocate that a citizen go to a business owner and say, do you know about, you know, this issue? And would you consider turning down your lights? Have you done that?
I think it's a great idea. And I'm in the process, actually, of going to a business owner who's they're building a new franchise in Blue Hill. And I've been trying to get in touch with them. And it takes effort on our parts, but I would really want to encourage us all to do that. And also, another issue is neighbors, people just not understanding or realizing that their lights, their outdoor lighting, can affect the night sky and vision. And oftentimes, I know up in Surrey and also on Millinocket Lake, I was told there's a slew of cabins on one side of the lake with lots of bright lights on them. And oftentimes, not always, it's all of us, but people come for the summer and then they leave for the winter and will leave a light on when they're away, thinking that they'll protect their property. And oftentimes it's across a lake and it really does affect people. But when it comes to actually saying something to your neighbor, it's really not easy to say something to your neighbor. So it's a challenge to figure out how to educate people, promote the dark skies, and but businesses maybe are a little easier, although it's to track down the person in charge of the business is a challenge. And the state of Maine, trying to track down the person who was in charge of lighting for the highways it took quite a bit of effort to do that. So yes, definitely, I would encourage us all to track down and talk to businesses and neighbors.
And I'll just quickly add that that website we've been mentioning, darksky.org, the IDA website, actually has like a great list of talking points, like especially very diverse ones. You know, you can try to make the point about the impacts of wildlife, but it kind of does all sorts of great ways to kind of cover the different ways that you can talk to different people, and gives great advice on getting town ordinances passed as well.
All right, Lori, thanks so much for your call. We're going to go to Rob, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks very much. I would just like to concur in everything that your panelists have discussed so far, but also wanted to fill in a few points. There was a recent American Medical Association study that came out in which it recommended that street lighting be reduced to under 3,000 degrees Kelvin, in other words, much less blue, because of the health effects on humans, in that too blue light actually inhibits the production of melatonin in the brain at night, which is really essential to fighting disease and things like cancer. So there's a direct health impact when the lighting in a community is too rich in the blue spectrum. The other thing I think it's important for people to consider is, with these LEDs being installed in so many places because of their energy efficiency, because they're so effective, they won't need maintenance for perhaps 20 years. So whatever we put in today, we may have to live with for 20 years, and it's therefore important for people to encourage less blue light being installed today, because if we don't, we're going to have the effects of that for a long time to come.
Well, Rob, thanks so much for calling in and making those points. John on Twitter tweets, the importance of making time to be outside and staring up at the Milky Way at least once a year is a vital thing I have tried to teach my children. I consider it essential to a person's peace and tranquility, an excellent way to contemplate our place in the universe. Ed, do you do anything like that?
I do. And where I live actually right now, I can't actually see the Milky Way, ironically enough. I live in the greater Portland. But you can see the Milky Way by going farther out into the country. And the fact of the matter is, if you are interested in astronomy, and you don't have to go too far in Maine to actually find the kind of dark skies you want to observe. And again, some people care less about astronomy, and they won't care about it no matter what we do. But if you do have an interest in astronomy, at least in staring up into the night sky and seeing some of the objects in our local vicinity, fortunately in Maine, you have ample opportunity to do exactly that.
I'd like to say that there's a superintendent now of the Acadian National Monument, and he is putting in paperwork to the Dark Sky Association to hopefully designate that area as some sort of dark sky reserve, preserve, or place. And if you go to darksky.org, there are places around the world that are designated as dark sky reserves. And there is one over the border from Jackman in Mount Maguntuk, which I haven't been to. But and also on that note, the Friends of Katahdin Woods and Waters has a website. And on their website, it will give the date of the Stars Over Katahdin event, which happens on October 6th. Also, we're hoping, and maybe that is happening right now, Andy Bossy is the director of Friends Over Katahdin. You can write on the website. There is a place to talk to management about your interest in dark skies or how you would like to see the National Monument in the future. So there are ways to talk
okay.
with them.
And, you know, you mentioned the Stars Over Katahdin event that you are involved in, but Acadia also has a night sky festival, right?
Yes, Acadia has, I don't know how many years now, maybe 7 years, they have a 7-day night sky festival. Last year we did the Stars Over Katahdin. You have to do it around the new moon, so that's the darkest area of the night sky, darkest time.
That's a good tip, Ed. If you're going to take that road trip out into the country, if you live in Bangor or Portland and Lewiston, maybe do it on a night when you've got a not when there's a full moon. But
exactly, because the full moon is actually 9 times brighter than the quarter moon because of the way the light is reflected back into space. So if you want to observe the sky, especially if you want to observe a meteor shower, you are advised not to go out when there's a full moon because lunar light interference will be significant, so much so that it will actually impede your viewing of the night sky. So go out when there's a new moon or a crescent moon, preferably, because then the lunar light interference will be minimal and you'll have the greater opportunity to see more in the night sky.
Sounds obvious now that you say it, but something to think about, Nancy.
I also wanted to mention that Surrey, the town of Surrey, which is between across the waters from Acadia National Park, we have stars over Surrey, and this year will be about our 4th time that we've done a star party, and this year we'll be doing it with partnering with the Blue Hill Heritage Trust. And I would love to encourage people who are listening or anyone in Maine to have a star party. And really all you need to do is to get together a group of people in an area that is large enough so you can see the night sky around the new moon. And you don't need an astronomer, but I know there are many astronomers around Maine who just love to travel, and they have a lot of enthusiasm and love to share that with people. So think about organizing a star party in your area.
All right. Well, before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to talk about racism and cross-racial conversations with a woman who has a blog called Black Girl in Maine. Her name's Shay Stewart Booley, and Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. Thanks for your support.
When confession and forgiveness are both so central to evangelical belief, how to differentiate between sexual sin and crime?
If I highlight how bad I was, then the story of the grace and forgiveness that God offers is all the more amazing.
Balancing redemption and accountability in evangelical churches this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public has 2 summer positions available for college or technical school students who are interested in careers in news, journalism, digital news, and/or technical broadcasting fields. Candidates should ideally be attending an institution based in Maine or have an existing connection to the state of Maine. Application deadline is just around the corner. That's January 29th. More information is available at mainepublic.org. Just click on About and then Careers, or contact the Human Resources Department at 207-330-4506. Excuse me while I kiss the
sky. Welcome back. You're listening to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, efforts to keep dark skies in Maine. Joining me today, Doug Hitchcox of Maine Audubon, Ed Gleason of USM's Planetarium, and Nancy Hathaway, mindfulness instructor and dark skies advocate. Join our conversation 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Karen on Facebook writes, I mentioned to a neighbor that an outdoor spotlight was waking me up. It took him under 24 hours to re-aim it. Your neighbors may be very accommodating than you think. So thanks, Karen, for that message. Ben sends in an email, love looking up at the night sky and realizing how insignificant life is. And then Elizabeth emails, organized municipalities can adopt an lighting ordinance that sets out standards for lighting for new projects. Many Maine towns have done this. The document provides background on dark skies along with guidance for municipal ordinances that promote dark skies. So we're going to go to Liz, who's calling from North Yarmouth. Hi, Liz. Go ahead.
Hi. Great program. I'm wondering if artificial light can manipulate the reproduction of our migrating birds. by increasing the length of daylight, or at least appearing to increase the length of daylight.
I'm not sure exactly how it would impact overall breeding, but the risk is that birds use photoperiod as kind of the cue of when they should migrate. So they're tuned into what is the amount of daylight in the day. And when that starts getting shorter, that's what's going to tell them time to migrate south if we're in the northern hemisphere. So there's certainly the risk that if they're living in an area that is subjected to 24 hours of light, they might miss those cues. And I shouldn't even say 24 hours. It could just be, turning lights on a little earlier, essentially expanding that photo period. Then, you could have bigger risks of just not being timed with their migration, which is more about being synced up with the food sources that they're looking for. So they could either be arriving too late, leaving too early, and time will tell.
Liz, thanks for your question. We'll go to Lisa calling from Wilton. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks. I was just wanted to kind of comment and ask a question about the wind turbines that are going up around rural Maine. So when we bought our house, one of the things that attracted us to the neighborhood was that we don't have any street lights, which is really nice. And our houses are kind of far enough apart where we don't have to be bothered by spotlights. And we looked out at nothing, just the sky. So since then, this, array of wind turbines went in, and they're not, the lights that are emitted from that, they're just the red flashing aviation lights. They don't have a glow like you would get from like a paper mill. But they're high, They're 400 feet themselves, and then they're on top of mountains that are over 1,000 feet. So it's affected us personally, how we view the sky, and I'm just curious for feedback about how you feel that affects the night sky.
I'll quickly say I'm glad to hear that they're blinking lights. It's known that a static light on, whether it's a wind turbine, a cell tower, a lighthouse, those constant lights are what will really have an impact on wildlife, especially migrating birds. So that's kind of a great kind of first step that a lot of developers can do to essentially minimize that impact.
Is the fact that they're red and blinking make a difference between being blue or white or yellow?
Great question. I'm not sure. Birds can see the full light spectrum that we do. They can see into the ultraviolet spectrum. So I bet it's more about the intensity or that overall brightness of the light rather than...
Well, the light color will make a difference. I mean, if you notice, if people who will go out for star parties with a star chart will go with a red gel on their flashlight, the red gel, the monochromatic red, will impair light, dark eye viewing less than other colors. So the blue is more problematic. The reds are not as much so, the way that our eyes see. And that's why in observatories you'll often see they'll use red lights around the perimeter. That way they illuminate the star charts without actually interfering with the dark sky adaptation of the eyes.
Or like in a dark room. Yeah,
exactly.
Interesting. Lisa, thanks so much for your question. An email from Bill. I have a Phippsburg campground and have a clear view of the night sky. We have a special viewing of the close moon here. I have a friend in the Southern Maine Astronomers Club who's very interested in viewing sites. Does our Department of Tourism have a list of potential viewing sites or sites of star parties? He asks if the Department of Tourism does, but is there any kind of list somewhere of a place someone can go and find out where to go to a star party?
The best thing to do, if you go to the Southern Maine Astronomers website or the Astronomical Society of Northern New England, I think there's Penobscot Valley Stargazers, you'll find astronomical societies in different places around the state. They'll have scheduled star parties, and the members there will also know other locations where there are dark skies. So I would advise you, I don't know if this is centralized, it might be a consolidated listing through the State Tourism Office, but at least through local night sky and astronomical societies, they'll definitely have that information for them.
I love the question. I'd say call the Department of Tourism and request it.
We'll go to Amy, who's calling from York. Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm on the planning board in York, and this is an issue, the dark skies, that we've been dealing with for a few years now. And while we haven't adopted a full comprehensive dark skies ordinance, we have done several smaller things. And I know somebody who had emailed, you mentioned about the ordinance that can be used for controlling light with new projects. And that's something that we take a look at, and we have requirements to reduce glare and to point lights down at the ground and not have the ambient light overhead. And I really wanted to encourage folks that are interested in this and are concerned about how to maybe go about advocating for it to start with their local planning board or their board of selectmen or their local town government, because I know for my own board, we were very interested when it was first brought to our attention and have since taken steps to make changes and to reduce the glare and the light. And we're way down in southern Maine where we probably have more of a problem with it from neighboring communities. And, you know, so it's even more important.
Well, Amy, let me ask you this. What has the reception been in the town of York to your committee and your efforts? Have businesses been eager to go along? Have, you know, private landowners wanted to go along, or has this been a challenge?
It has not been a contentious challenge at all. The concern that's often raised is one of safety. And there's a member of our board who is very versatile with the dark skies. I think he's a member of the national organization, and he can explain how you can still get the lighting so you can have safety and you know, still have the entrances to buildings lit and driveways without causing light pollution. So that's the primary concern. The developers, people building homes and commercial projects are all very willing to be cooperative.
Well, Amy, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your experience in the town of York. Going to move on to Scarborough and Tom. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a observation that I've made over the years, and I'd like your guest's opinion in this regard. The advent of CFL lighting and the subsequent introduction of the LED lighting brought about all of the very blue-shaded lighting that your guests have mentioned, very high in the Kelvin scale lighting. And beginning many years ago when the CFLs first came in, whenever I would comment to some folks regarding the color of the new light bulb they've just put on the porch, I saw a pattern where many folks would simply respond, well, it's brighter. And I would say, well, yes, but it's also a different color. And I'd get a blank stare. Well, it's brighter. And that's really not the point I was trying to make at all. Recently on Maine Public Radio, I listened to a story, and I don't remember from where it came, having to do with the evolution of human eyesight. And it very specifically referenced the sensitivity to blue light, that it varies wildly among individuals. And I'm now thinking that some folks just don't see the color difference between that.
Yeah, that's probably, yeah, you're probably onto something. Tom, Doug, this is something you know a little bit about.
Yeah, so we were talking about this over the break where I think if people have no idea what we're talking about, this essentially temperature of light, I know especially iPhone users might notice when you have what's called night shift enabled, when the sun goes down, your screen actually starts to give off these yellow or warmer colors. It should be under like accessibility. You can turn it on and off. That would be a fun test for people to do tonight when it gets dark. I'll add from a wildlife perspective, we know that these different types of lights, you know, emitting different wavelengths will have different impacts on especially insects. So like for moths, for people who study moths, they'll actually put lights out to draw those moths in. It makes them very easy to catch and look at. And so the incandescent bulbs have the highest capture rate, followed by CFLs, then halogen lights, then LEDs with the cooler temperature. So that's why we not only knowing that LEDs are more adjustable, but having those essentially warmer LEDs tend to be some of the best ones that you can put out, at least to have a minimal impact on wildlife.
Tom, thanks for your call. We're going to go up to Penobscot and Lawton. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead.
Hey, my question is, I was thinking about international students. So many schools now have international students, and I've had international students from China and Korea that were at GSA come to my farm years ago when my kids were in school, but they had never seen the sky before. And it was an overwhelming experience for them emotionally. They had never seen the sky, especially those kids. I think they were living in Beijing. So it makes me think about doing something to connect the night sky folks with international students that are growing in our public and private schools.
Yeah, Lawton, I've heard that. I've heard that many of the students who come, especially from China, for example, to Millinocket High School, it's the fresh air and the night sky that they so value.
I've heard the same from Millinocket area and also Colby students. And it seems to be the Chinese students that have never seen not only the Milky Way, but so many, even I don't even know of any stars. Yeah.
Lawton, thank you. A couple of people have a question that I want to ask, too, and we're going to close the show with this. Ed, how do we see the Aurora Borealis if we've never seen it? How do we know when and where?
Well, the best way, the Aurora Borealis is a bit elusive. If you consult websites such as spaceweather.com, it'll tell you, it'll give you a KP index when you might be able to see it. In this region of the world, we see it on average about 4 to 6 times a year. It's very difficult to see sometimes owing to the low light. In October 2003, I saw an aurora borealis that actually covered the entire perimeter of the sky with red light. It was actually rather bright because it was a coronal mass ejection that produced a lot of solar energy that came toward our planet, exciting the atmosphere. So the best thing to do is go to spaceweather.com. If there's a solar event like a coronal mass ejection, they'll see it before it reaches us. So do that. Go out about 4 or 6 times a year. Best to see between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. around the equinoxes. But again, the more active the sun, the more likely the aurora event will be.
And just give yourself time. And we will put that as well as some other resources on our Facebook page. Thank you all so much for being here. That is Ed Gleason, astronomer and planetarium manager at USM. Nancy Hathaway is also here, chair of the Surrey Conservation Commission and mindfulness instructor. And Doug Hitchcox is staff naturalist at Maine Audubon. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today and was the musical producer for today's program. He found all the great music we've sprinkled throughout this program. Owen Manahan answered your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. For a list of those songs and artists you heard on today's program, please visit the Maine Calling website or Facebook page. Tomorrow on the program, Cross-Racial Conversations. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.